Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about choosing the right diet. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then, you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Food. Nowadays, what we buy to eat is determined by shifting health studies. Carbs are good for you. No, they're bad. Fats make you fat. No, they don't. And food labels only increase our confusion. Michael Pollan, journalist and professor of science and environmental journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, has written a new book called In Defense of Food, in which he inveighs against nutritionism, a kind of ideology that sees foods as mere packets of nutrients whose interactions must be interpreted by scientists. And he says we shouldn't allow ourselves to be intimidated by studies or news reports or especially food labeling. Humans can thrive on all sorts of diets. Some live healthy lives on nothing but cattle or seafood. In fact, he says, there's only one diet that has consistently proved hazardous to our health.
Yeah, ours, the Western diet. It's actually, you know, people who have done the sort of ethnographic research around food have found this astonishing array of different traditional diets on which people have been extremely healthy. But there is one diet that it appears that we are poorly adapted to, and that is what we call the Western diet. And this diet makes people fat and makes them diabetic. It gives them heart disease. It gives them an assortment of cancers. It's just very toxic to our bodies.
You say by the early 80s, the American supermarket underwent a kind of transformation. So, Michael, if I fell asleep in the 40s and woke up in the 80s in an A&P, what would I notice about the food?
You would have noticed that the packages would talk about how much cholesterol or how little cholesterol, how much fat, how much sugar, a whole lot of science. The whole discourse surrounding food underwent a revolution, and that's where we are today. We speak about food as if they are a collection of nutrients, and the nutrients are what matters.
So let's talk about some of the guidance that you do offer in very clear terms. Some of the rules for healthy eating are don't eat anything that doesn't rot, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize, don't eat anything that has an unfamiliar or unpronounceable name, don't eat food that features health claims on their labels.
Yeah, that might seem a little counterintuitive, but the reason I concluded that health claims should be essentially avoided is by looking at the kinds of products that carry them. You find health claims on processed foods, fruits and vegetables. They don't have the budget. They don't have the packaging. The healthiest food is silent. So the kind of advice I offer is an attempt to bore back through the science to the native wisdom that we once had. Tradition around food is not just turning back the clock. It's the distilled wisdom of the group. I mean, what people eat is the result of generations upon generations of essentially dietary trial and error to figure out what keeps people healthy and happy.
And you suggest that the science or the pseudoscience behind nutritionism is based on very, very little.
The nutrition science on which all these dietary recommendations are based is very well-meaning, but it's also very crude. We may figure this out at some point. We may understand nutrition better, and I'm not saying we should stop doing the science. I'm saying that the media and the consumer should take it all with many, many grains of salt and watch it and be interested in it, but not change your behavior based on the latest nutritional study because it's simply not strong enough as a guide.
Food. Nowadays, what we buy to eat is determined by shifting health studies. Carbs are good for you. No, they're bad. Fats make you fat. No, they don't. And food labels only increase our confusion. Michael Pollan, journalist and professor of science and environmental journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, has written a new book called In Defense of Food, in which he inveighs against nutritionism, a kind of ideology that sees foods as mere packets of nutrients whose interactions must be interpreted by scientists. And he says we shouldn't allow ourselves to be intimidated by studies or news reports or especially food labeling. Humans can thrive on all sorts of diets. Some live healthy lives on nothing but cattle or seafood. In fact, he says, there's only one diet that has consistently proved hazardous to our health.
Yeah, ours, the Western diet. It's actually, you know, people who have done the sort of ethnographic research around food have found this astonishing array of different traditional diets on which people have been extremely healthy. But there is one diet that it appears that we are poorly adapted to, and that is what we call the Western diet. And this diet makes people fat and makes them diabetic. It gives them heart disease. It gives them an assortment of cancers. It's just very toxic to our bodies.
You say by the early 80s, the American supermarket underwent a kind of transformation. So, Michael, if I fell asleep in the 40s and woke up in the 80s in an A&P, what would I notice about the food?
You would have noticed that the packages would talk about how much cholesterol or how little cholesterol, how much fat, how much sugar, a whole lot of science. The whole discourse surrounding food underwent a revolution, and that's where we are today. We speak about food as if they are a collection of nutrients, and the nutrients are what matters.
So let's talk about some of the guidance that you do offer in very clear terms. Some of the rules for healthy eating are don't eat anything that doesn't rot, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize, don't eat anything that has an unfamiliar or unpronounceable name, don't eat food that features health claims on their labels.
Yeah, that might seem a little counterintuitive, but the reason I concluded that health claims should be essentially avoided is by looking at the kinds of products that carry them. You find health claims on processed foods, fruits and vegetables. They don't have the budget. They don't have the packaging. The healthiest food is silent. So the kind of advice I offer is an attempt to bore back through the science to the native wisdom that we once had. Tradition around food is not just turning back the clock. It's the distilled wisdom of the group. I mean, what people eat is the result of generations upon generations of essentially dietary trial and error to figure out what keeps people healthy and happy.
And you suggest that the science or the pseudoscience behind nutritionism is based on very, very little.
The nutrition science on which all these dietary recommendations are based is very well-meaning, but it's also very crude. We may figure this out at some point. We may understand nutrition better, and I'm not saying we should stop doing the science. I'm saying that the media and the consumer should take it all with many, many grains of salt and watch it and be interested in it, but not change your behavior based on the latest nutritional study because it's simply not strong enough as a guide.
Task 2. You are going to listen to an interview with the director of time. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then, you will hear the recording twice. While listening, answer the questions 7 through 12 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
If there's one place on Earth where you can come to find the time, it's here in Washington, D.C. This is the home of the U.S. Naval Observatory, one of a select bunch of time lords dotted across the planet who are the keepers of time on Earth.
Universal time, 19 hours, 54 minutes, exactly.
A time now derived from atomic clocks.
Dennis McCarthy, Director of Time.
We defined a time in the 1950s based on the position of the moon with respect to the stars. We needed a more accurate kind of time. Not only is it does it have to be more accurate, but it has to be more accessible. Yeah. That accessible kind of time is provided by atomic clocks. What we need to tell time is something which repeats with great regularity that you can count on. How well we can tell time depends on which atom you're using.
Yeah.
So we choose certain ones to use for keeping atomic time.
So how can atoms give us the time?
What you can do... An atom is very crudely... The atomic nucleus sits there and electrons sit in orbit around the nucleus. But they only sit in specific places. So you can't have them anywhere. You can have them here, and here, and here. And when they jump up to there, and then back down to there again, they emit light. And that light has a particular frequency.
And it's this light that allows us to tell the time so precisely. Inside the clocks are the atoms of a rare metal called cesium. The electrons in the cesium atoms are made to jump up. Then as they fall back down, they give out light. These light waves peak over 9 billion times every second. And it's this light that drives the clock, effectively producing 9 billion ticks for each atomic second. This number never changes, never alters, and that's why it's so accurate.
So the atomic clock is actually putting out an electronic signal, which is essentially analogous to the ticking of a pendulum clock, you know, a pendulum clock which might tick once every second or once every couple of seconds. This thing is providing us something which is going 9 billion times per second. So it provides us a very fine definition of time. We actually have a number of clocks at the Naval Observatory located all over the grounds. Here's one of them. This is the Master Clock System 1. This is the Master Clock System 2.
So if I want an answer to the question, what time is it? There it is.
That's it.
Universal time, 20 hours, 0 minutes, exactly.
Thank you.
If there's one place on Earth where you can come to find the time, it's here in Washington, D.C. This is the home of the U.S. Naval Observatory, one of a select bunch of time lords dotted across the planet who are the keepers of time on Earth.
Universal time, 19 hours, 54 minutes, exactly.
A time now derived from atomic clocks.
Dennis McCarthy, Director of Time.
We defined a time in the 1950s based on the position of the moon with respect to the stars. We needed a more accurate kind of time. Not only is it does it have to be more accurate, but it has to be more accessible. Yeah. That accessible kind of time is provided by atomic clocks. What we need to tell time is something which repeats with great regularity that you can count on. How well we can tell time depends on which atom you're using.
Yeah.
So we choose certain ones to use for keeping atomic time.
So how can atoms give us the time?
What you can do... An atom is very crudely... The atomic nucleus sits there and electrons sit in orbit around the nucleus. But they only sit in specific places. So you can't have them anywhere. You can have them here and here and here. And when they jump up to there and then back down to there again, they emit light. And that light has a particular frequency.
And it's this light that allows us to tell the time so precisely. Inside the clocks are the atoms of a rare metal called cesium. The electrons in the cesium atoms are made to jump up. Then as they fall back down, they give out light. These light waves peak over 9 billion times every second. And it's this light that drives the clock, effectively producing 9 billion ticks for each atomic second. This number never changes, never alters, and that's why it's so accurate.
So the atomic clock is actually putting out an electronic signal, which is essentially analogous to the ticking of a pendulum clock, you know, a pendulum clock which might tick once every second or once every couple of seconds. This thing is providing us something which is going 9 billion times per second. So it provides us a very fine definition of the time. We actually have a number of clocks at the Naval Observatory located all over the grounds. Here's one of them. This is the Master Clock System 1. This is the Master Clock System 2.
So if I want an answer to the question, what time is it? There it is.
That's it.
Universal time, 20 hours, 0 minutes, exactly.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a recording about a new anti-aging technique. First, you have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then, you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 13 to 18. Put a cross in the correct box. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The key to producing young-looking skin has been found by genetic scientists in California. Well, young-looking skin in mice, anyway. But there are hopes that it could be applied to humans. Our science correspondent, James Randerson, told me how it works.
Well, I must say, John, that you're looking very in fine fettle this morning and don't need any of this, but it's researchers from Stanford University who have fiddled with the genes in mice, or one gene in particular, in fact, to essentially reverse the aging process in the skin. It's quite remarkable. And this gene is significant because it controls the activity of lots of other genes. So it's kind of, you know, the volume control on a whole suite of genes which are involved in the aging process in skin.
And can this process work in people?
Well, at the moment, that's a moot point. They haven't done the experiments in people, but we do know that the human version of this gene is on a region of our chromosomes, which has already, in several studies, been linked to aging. So, the evidence looks like the gene is doing something very similar in people. But there is a very important caveat to this, which is the reversal of aging that they've shown in these mice took about 2 weeks to do. I mean, it's remarkable it could be so quick, really. But in humans, they say it would probably be a bad idea to sort of use this as a kind of fountain of youth effect, if you like, and try and, you know, completely reverse the aging in a person. Because this gene controls so many other genes involving, the immune systems and cancers and things like that, you probably don't want to be messing around with it too much for a long periods of time, because you could have all sorts of unforeseen consequences. So in humans, they're at the moment thinking of targeting things like wound healing rather than sort of aging per se.
What does this discovery tell us about the aging process and what it actually is?
Well, this is an interesting point, really, because I mean, to the layman, aging seems like a kind of accumulation of life's knocks, you know, wear and tear happening to the skin, resulting in wrinkles and generally less supple-looking skin. But actually, it's not like that at all. It's a kind of active process whereby genetic changes that change your skin. And previous experiments have shown that this is the case, that you can do things to rejuvenate skin. And it's really kind of reversing this genetic process, and that's what they've done.
There's a huge amount of money, of course, to be made out of anti-aging processes. Are the cosmetics industry, for instance, rubbing their hands with glee today?
Well, I'm sure they are. I mean, it is going to be some while before any of this finds its way into humans. I mean, typically people talk about, once you start doing human trials, it taking, maybe 5 years to get to a product. So, we're not even at that stage yet. So, we shouldn't get too excited. Interestingly, though, yesterday I rang up various kind of associations of cosmetic doctors and things like that. Now, potentially, they would be the ones to lose out to all this. And strangely, their press officers found it very hard to get anyone to talk about it.
So if this was applied to people, how would it actually be applied, this process?
Actually, this is the million-dollar question in all applications of gene therapy. The problem is, how do you get the genes to change their activity in lots and lots of different cells in the same place all at the same time? And there really aren't very many good answers to that. I mean, some ideas are you put the gene that you want inside a virus and then that infects cells, but that's all a little bit, no one's very keen on those kind of ideas. Or you have these sort of little fatty particles that have what you want inside. Now, in this case, what you're doing is actually shutting down the activity of a particular gene. So you'd need, you need something inside your fatty particle that then binds to the thing that you want to shut down. So, those questions are not really answered yet.
The key to producing young-looking skin has been found by genetic scientists in California. Well, young-looking skin in mice, anyway. But there are hopes that it could be applied to humans. Our science correspondent, James Randerson, told me how it works.
Well, I must say, John, that you're looking very in fine fettle this morning and don't need any of this, but it's researchers from Stanford University who have fiddled with the genes in mice, or one gene in particular, in fact, to essentially reverse the aging process in the skin. Now, it's quite remarkable. And this gene is significant because it controls the activity of lots of other genes. So it's kind of, you know, the volume control on a whole suite of genes which are involved in the aging process in skin.
And can this process work in people?
Well, at the moment, that's a moot point. They haven't done the experiments in people, but we do know that the human version of this gene is on a region of our chromosomes, which has already, in several studies, been linked to aging. So, you know, the evidence looks like the gene is doing something very similar in people. But there is a very important caveat to this, which is the reversal of aging that they've shown in these mice took about 2 weeks to do. I mean, it's remarkable it could be so quick, really. But in humans, they say it would probably be a bad idea to sort of use this as a kind of fountain of youth effect, if you like, and try and, you know, completely reverse the aging in a person. Because this gene controls so many other genes involving, you know, the immune system, certain cancers and things like that, you probably don't want to be messing around with it too much for a long periods of time, because you could have all sorts of unforeseen consequences. So in humans, they're at the moment, they're thinking of targeting things like wound healing rather than sort of aging per se.
What does this discovery tell us about the aging process and what it actually is?
Well, this is an interesting point, really, because I mean, to the layman, aging seems like a kind of accumulation of life's knocks, you know, wear and tear happening to the skin, resulting in wrinkles and generally less supple-looking skin. But actually, it's not like that at all. It's a kind of active process whereby genetic changes that change your skin. And previous experiments have shown that this is the case, that you can do things to rejuvenate skin. And it's really kind of reversing this genetic process, and that's what they've done.
There's a huge amount of money, of course, to be made out of anti-aging processes. Are the cosmetics industry, for instance, rubbing their hands with glee today?
Well, I'm sure they are. I mean, it is going to be some while before any of this finds its way into humans. I mean, typically people talk about, once you start doing human trials, it taking, you know, maybe 5 years to get to a product. So, you know, we're not even at that stage yet. So, you know, we shouldn't get too excited. Interestingly, though, yesterday I rang up various kind of associations of cosmetic doctors and things like that. Now, potentially they would be the ones to lose out to all this. And strangely, their press officers found it very hard to get anyone to talk about it.
So if this was applied to people, how would it actually be applied, this process?
Actually, this is the million-dollar question in all applications of gene therapy. The problem is, how do you get the genes to change their activity in lots and lots of different cells in the same place all at the same time? And there really aren't very many good answers to that. I mean, some ideas are you put the gene that you want inside a virus and then that infects cells, but that's all a little bit, no one's very keen on those kind of ideas. Or you have these sort of little fatty particles that have what you want inside. Now, in this case, what you're doing is actually shutting down the activity of a particular gene. So you'd need, you need something inside your fatty particle that then binds to the thing that you want to shut down. So, you know, those questions are not really answered yet.
Task 4. You are going to listen to a recording about racist advertising. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then, you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 19 to 26 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
Corn chips, I love them, I do. I want Fritos corn chips, I'll get them from you.
In 1967, the Frito Bandito stole his way to the top of the advertising food chain when Frito-Lay used the animated outlaw to sell corn chips to kids. A pistol-packing Mexican thief, drawn by Tex Avery and voiced by Mel Blanc, he quickly drew the ire of Mexican Americans who fought back. Within a few years, the Bandito was banished. But as reporter David Siegel noted in Slate this week, the Frito Bandito wasn't the first racist spokescharacter to hawk food products. Siegel joins us now for a tour of advertising infamy. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
So I want to start with a spokescharacter that's been in the news recently, because after 60 years of faithfully adorning boxes of rice as an avuncular cook, he's finally received a promotion. That's, of course, Uncle Ben.
Yeah, Uncle Ben was introduced in 1943. He was the bow-tied chef on the box. And recently, Mars, which now owns Uncle Ben, decided to give him a promotion. And they have made him the CEO of the fictional Uncle Ben Incorporated.
Well, Uncle Ben was basically the image is he's an Uncle Tom, right?
He's an Uncle Tom. This is a character that people might not know about now, but at the time when he was introduced in the 40s, the Tom was a very popular figure in advertising, and there were dozens of companies that created Toms as spokes characters. They were basically all the same person. They were black, they were in their 40s or over. And they had no ambition. They were very, very happy, and they were just pleased to be serving white people. Oddly enough, they haven't given him much of an upgrade in wardrobe. He still has this bow tie that he had in the 40s, but he's got a sort of swishier jacket. He has a wood-paneled office and a Mac, as well as a date book filled with his upcoming travel plans.
So Uncle Ben has really had an amazing rise through the ranks, but there's another character that I noticed in the grocery store the other day after reading your piece that seems pretty much the same as ever, the cream of wheat guy?
Yeah, Rastus predates Uncle Ben by a few decades. He was this invention by the guys that started Cream of Wheat. Rastus would sometimes have a chalkboard, and he would write messages on the chalkboard, and they were written in the kind of broken English of a slave. And that's really what these characters were. They were kind of holdovers from the era of slavery. And in the South, they kind of operated as a way of saying to Northerners, you know, if segregation is so bad, why are these people so happy? Mm-hmm. It was a kind of implicit argument for segregation. And in the North, I think they appealed to people that felt like they wanted a butler. They wanted to feel privileged. And these characters sort of did that.
There was a Shirley Temple movie where she plays the daughter of a Confederate soldier, and it's the same thing. They're on a plantation in the South before the war, and the slaves are all just really happy, dancing. Mm-hmm. After the war, they're really miserable.
Right.
Nobody's taking care of them, and I guess they have nobody to cook for.
The example of that is, of course, Aunt Jemima. She got her start in 1899. She was this creation of Chris Rutt, who had seen a minstrel character by the name of Aunt Jemima and decided that this would be the character that would promote his new self-rising pancake mix.
You know, Aunt Jemima, morning, noon, or night, there's nothing.
Corn chips, I love them, I do. I want Fritos corn chips, I'll get them from you.
In 1967, the Frito Bandito stole his way to the top of the advertising food chain when Frito-Lay used the animated outlaw to sell corn chips to kids. A pistol-packing Mexican thief, drawn by Tex Avery and voiced by Mel Blanc, he quickly drew the ire of Mexican-Americans, who fought back. Within a few years, the Bandito was banished. But as reporter David Siegel noted in Slate this week, the Frito Bandito wasn't the first racist spokescharacter to hawk food products. Siegel joins us now for a tour of advertising infamy. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
So I want to start with a spokescharacter that's been in the news recently, because after 60 years of faithfully adorning boxes of rice as an avuncular cook, he's finally received a promotion. That's, of course, Uncle Ben.
Yeah, Uncle Ben was introduced in 1943. He was the bow-tied chef on the box. And recently, Mars, which now owns Uncle Ben, decided to give him a promotion. And they have made him the CEO of the fictional Uncle Ben Incorporated.
Well, Uncle Ben was basically the image is he's an Uncle Tom, right?
He's an Uncle Tom. This is a character that people might not know about now, but at the time when he was introduced in the 40s, the Tom was a very popular figure in advertising, and there were dozens of companies that created Toms as spokes characters. They were basically all the same person. They were black, they were in their 40s or over, and they had no ambition. They were very, very happy, and they were just pleased to be serving white people. Oddly enough, they haven't given him much of an upgrade in wardrobe. He still has this bow tie that he had in the 40s, but he's got a sort of swishier jacket. He has a wood-paneled office and a Mac, as well as a date book filled with his upcoming travel plans.
So Uncle Ben has really had an amazing rise through the ranks, but there's another character that I noticed in the grocery store the other day after reading your piece that seems pretty much the same as ever, the cream of wheat guy?
Yeah, Rastus predates Uncle Ben by a few decades. He was this invention by the guys that started Cream of Wheat. Rastus would sometimes have a chalkboard, and he would write messages on the chalkboard, and they were written in the kind of broken English of a slave. And that's really what these characters were. They were kind of holdovers from the era of slavery. And in the South, they kind of operated as a way of saying to Northerners, you know, if segregation is so bad, why are these people so happy? Mm-hmm. It was a kind of implicit argument for segregation. And in the North, I think they appealed to people that felt like they wanted a butler. They wanted to feel privileged. And these characters sort of did that.
There was a Shirley Temple movie where she plays the daughter of a Confederate soldier, and it's the same thing. They're on a plantation in the South before the war, and the slaves are all just really happy, dancing. Mm-hmm. After the war, they're really miserable.
Right.
Nobody's taking care of them, and I guess they have nobody to cook for.
The example of that is, of course, Aunt Jemima. She got her start in 1899. She was this creation of Chris Rutt, who had seen a minstrel character by the name of Aunt Jemima and decided that this would be the character that would promote his new self-rising pancake mix.
You know, Aunt Jemima, morning, noon, or night, there's nothing.
This is the end of the listening test.